This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. There may be no disease in recent history that's caused more heartbreak than HIV/AIDS. But the story of AIDS isn't just about suffering and death. It's also about hope and life. On our show today, AIDS up close. In Thailand, Buddhist monks lead the battle against HIV.
When you have loving kindness or compassion in you, then definitely you would do something in order to solve the problem.
In South Africa, an infected mother collects keepsakes for her kids to remember her by. And from Botswana, a tribute to a different kind of beauty queen.
I'm very proud of being crowned Miss HIV Stigma Free because I'm saving the nation. I'm living positively with HIV.
Welcome to the World Vision Report. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Today we bring you AIDS Up Close, a look at the lives of people living with HIV/AIDS. More than 33 million people around the world now have the disease, and children are the worst off. Many of them have been infected at birth. Even more face life as orphans. AIDS worker Dave Snyder was visiting a clinic in Kampala, Uganda, when a small boy arrived with his grandmother to hear the results of his HIV test.
The counselor beckons, so I inch down the thin, dark passage and squeeze into the counseling room. A small boy and his grandmother sit waiting, her hand resting gently on his. They have been given the news, the soft-voiced counselor explains. And by news, we both know what he means. I look over at the boy and his grandmother, close enough to touch. There are all the years of life between them, her cheeks sunken with age, his eyes set like moons in the creaseless skin of his face. Were it not for the nature of this room, you would not guess that the tragedy is his. I turn back to the counselor who offers their story. Both of the boy's parents are dead, the counselor begins, killed by the virus they have left him. My eyes turn to the small child, who is 4 years old and who does not move so much as a finger. His shoes are ragged and his tiny waist is lost in the knot of a green sweater borrowed for the morning walk to the hospital. The thin yellow curtain across the doorway rustles as other people shuffle past to get their news in other rooms. I stare at the strength of this woman, her eyes deep set, her face ancient but firm, this old woman who must be a young mother again. She is 85 and she begs now for food, the counselor says. But it is the boy's face that keeps drawing my eyes. In light of the news, he seems impossibly small, swallowed up by his wooden chair. His expression is unblinking. I cannot cast a single line across the foot of space between us. A four-year-old boy, his world erased, and me with everything. With nothing more left to learn, they rise to leave. The grandmother gathers a small green file from the desk, in which are folded the first pages of the child's new life as a patient. In it are buried the ugly block letters of this latest burden, divined from the child's blood like some secret cryptic message, and boiled down to the single word they came today to hear. Detected.
That was aid worker Dave Snyder. You can see photos of the child and his grandmother at our website, worldvisionreport.org. The boy's test results showed that the HIV virus was detected in his blood. He is HIV positive. That's a devastating diagnosis for anyone. It can mean a life of stigma and shame. And up until recently, it meant almost certain death. But that's changing. Here to give us the latest on the AIDS pandemic is Dr. Thomas Coates. He's the director of the Global Health Program at the University of California in Los Angeles. I asked him whether he thought progress was being made in the fight against HIV.
Oh, there's really quite a bit of good news. I think one important piece of good news is that more and more people who need to get on anti-HIV medications are getting them. And the drugs give people hope, and it doesn't mean that death is inevitable. The year 2000 was a real pivotal turning point, and that was the first time that the International AIDS Conference was held in a developing country, and it was in Durban, South Africa. And that's when the world stood up and said, it's not okay that you can have access to medications if you come from a rich country, but you can't have access to those same life-saving medications if you come from a poor country. And President Bush and the administration started the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. There's the Global Fund for HIV, AIDS, and TB and malaria, and that has pumped a lot of resources in. Many countries have their own bilateral programs. All the European countries do, just like the U.S. does. So it's really generated a lot of hope and interest on the ground. I can't tell you what it means to the people who are living there and struggling with this disease on a day-by-day basis.
Even though more and more people are on these antiretroviral drugs and doing very well, it still seems there are more people being infected daily than there are going on treatment. Does this mean we're losing the fight?
That's exactly true. And we'll never treat our way out of this disease. And for every one person who goes on medications, six get infected. But, you know, some countries like Uganda have shown us that it is possible to turn the tide on that. Uganda just pulled out all the stops and they encouraged what they called zero grazing, that is reducing the number of sexual partners that people have. They encouraged delaying onset of first intercourse. They encouraged condoms. They encouraged counseling and testing. They had media programs, they had advertising, they just did everything that they could. And they reduced the rate of new infections by half. And what that shows is that even in countries that are poor, it's still possible to turn that around and really, really make a difference if you have strong political leadership from the top.
So if you were to say the one, two, or three major things that do turn a country around, one would be political leadership. What else are they all doing the same in the countries where it is working?
Well, it takes political leadership. It takes destigmatizing HIV so that people who have HIV are encouraged to speak out and tell other people that they have HIV. And that encourages people to come forward and get tested and counseled for HIV so that they can take precautions against infecting other people. And then the third thing is just widespread programs, getting it on the airwaves, getting it in the newspapers, having condoms available, encouraging delay of onset of intercourse. All of that makes a difference so that everybody is aware of what to do.
I'm wondering if any stories come to your mind as we talk that give you great encouragement or confidence that we will eventually win this battle against AIDS.
Well, the ultimate victory is on the ground, and it's by people taking care of other people. And I think it's that kind of on-the-ground response that makes all the difference in the world. And I have to tell you, there are lots and lots of people doing that. When I was in rural KwaZulu-Natal meeting with one of the Zulu chiefs, he gave a very stirring speech that I think everyone can reflect on. And he said, "How can I be chief of a nation when all of the people are dead?" It's really, really important that we all take HIV seriously and protect ourselves and our next generation from this disease so that we can thrive as a people and as a nation.
All right. Dr. Thomas Coates, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Dr. Thomas Coates, director of the Global Health Program at UCLA. He spoke to us from Los Angeles. We've just heard that the availability of life-saving drugs is bringing hope to many with HIV. It's also making them less frightened of being tested, less frightened of hearing the dreaded word, detected. Suzanne Marmion brings us this story from a small town in Zambia.
Kapiri Mposhi is the kind of town where the AIDS virus thrives. It's a transit center. Dusty tarmac cuts through the middle of town. The road draws in truckers and the prostitutes who serve them. Then there's the train that carries traders and travelers from Tanzania, refugees from Congo, and migrants from neighboring Mozambique. AIDS has spread widely here, but Lillian Chole says she hasn't been tested for HIV.
Because in the first place, I'm a married woman. I know what I do. but I don't know what my husband does. So even if I went for a test and then I came out positive, who's going to take care of me? That will kill me, because I know I've got the disease and I know I'm going to die.
This fatalism has long dissuaded many Africans from getting tested for HIV. AIDS was a death sentence for many Africans until recently. The drugs that have dramatically extended the lives of people with AIDS in the West weren't available in places like Kapiri and Mposhi. But that grim reality has begun to change. At this church in Kapiri and Mposhi, many in the congregation were dying from AIDS. But Pastor Travel Mwapa says the town recently turned a corner.
We are having a breakthrough.
He says members of his congregation who'd wasted into walking skeletons are stepping back from the grave.
By the grace of God, some are responding.
Just over a year ago, antiretroviral drugs arrived in Kapiri and Mposhi. These drugs, also called ARVs, are available for free at a clinic run by the group Doctors Without Borders. And with the drugs has come optimism.
Yeah, this is serious.
She's a man.
I'm telling you. That's right.
This new sense of hope has seeped into pop music. This song is a hit in Zambia and neighboring Malawi. Its lyrics, roughly translated, go, "Baby, those ARVs have made your hips so fat and so fine." Of course, to get those drugs that restore you to health, you have to get tested for HIV first. At Kapiri and Mposhi's hospital, medical worker Richard Kaki says that for the first time ever, an overwhelming number of people are coming to get tested for HIV.
Well, this time there's a solution. It wasn't like in the past where you knew and then nothing could be done to you.
Kaki says people in the community have seen sick neighbors go from lying on a stretcher to being well enough to walk and even play soccer.
So the community learned a lot from that. As a result, they got encouraged, coming in big numbers.
Kaki says before the arrival of ARVs, his testing center was virtually deserted. Now he says people who aren't even sick are crowding into his testing center to find out their HIV status. What's happening in Kapiri and Mposhi is becoming more commonplace in Africa as antiretrovirals become more widely available. When people see that there's hope, even if they're infected, many find the courage to test. For the World Vision Report, I'm Suzanne Marmion, Kapiri and Mposhi, Zambia.
Coming up, soccer is the most popular sport in the world. People love to watch it, and they love to play it. Now it's being used to spread the word about AIDS. That's ahead on the World Vision Report, AIDS Up Close. Stay with us.
Contraceptives, ni my injection. Disole ako yuza mwana wangu. Afuna ako kopeiwe. Afuna inasana kukachiro.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Some AIDS experts think we're losing the battle against HIV/AIDS. They cite the 14,000 new infections that occur every day. Others think we're winning the fight thanks to the availability of life-saving drugs. Both sides agree on one thing, that the key to stopping the spread of HIV is to prevent infection in the first place. And to do that, people need to know exactly how the disease spreads. But HIV is not always easy to talk about, especially in places where even mentioning it is taboo. Michael Kavanaugh brings us this story from the Dominican Republic.
In the late 1990s, American Kirk Friedrich was playing professional soccer in Zimbabwe, an impoverished country with one of the worst HIV rates in the world.
While I was playing in Africa, I lost quite a few friends and teammates to the disease, and it was always shocking to me the way that no one ever talked about the disease.
Friedrich believed something had to be done to overcome that taboo and to encourage HIV prevention. And he thought that that something might involve the game of soccer.
Soccer is life for so many kids, and it's one of those things that really brings people together. It breaks down cultural barriers, and when it comes to talking about HIV/AIDS, that could be one of the most important things.
So Friedrich, along with an American pediatrician, formed Grassroots Soccer. With money from foundations as well as private donations, Grassroots Soccer has run programs in 10 nations, including Zimbabwe, Botswana, and South Africa. Today, Friedrich is inflating soccer balls on a sugarcane plantation in the Dominican Republic, where Grassroots Soccer has sponsored a weekend tournament. The organization offers poor kids the chance to join youth leagues, and then, using soccer as the reward, the organization teaches them about the dangers of HIV. Today, about 100 children and young adults in dirty soccer uniforms gather around, itching for the chance to play. But before the game, a few lessons.
We're playing a game called Fact Nonsense, which is a game that teaches basic facts about HIV and AIDS, tests their knowledge and understanding.
American Paula Peacock Beata is Grassroots Soccer's point person in the Dominican Republic. She yells out statements like, young girls are at greater risk for getting AIDS than young boys, or you're more likely to get HIV if you already have a sexually transmitted disease. And then Peacock Beata asks them if it's a fact or if it's nonsense. Some of the kids are surprisingly knowledgeable, a testament to their previous Grassroots Soccer training. The Dominican Republic might seem like an odd place to host a soccer program, given how popular baseball is here. But most of these kids are from neighboring Haiti, where soccer is king. Haitians provide cheap labor throughout the Dominican Republic, especially in the sugar plantations. The workers live in small communities called batés, where work conditions are harsh and dangerous. About 1 to 2% of the Dominican Republic is HIV positive, but that number might be as high as 5 or 10% for residents of the batés. On the soccer field, Peacock Beata leads the group in another lesson. Two lines are formed, one for girls and one for boys, in front of two rows of orange cones.
So we're playing a game called Risk Field now, and there are cones set up, and the kids are going to dribble through them. Each cone will represent a risk that's in their lives. So unprotected sex would be one, prostitution, for example. So then they're going to be dribbling the ball through the cones, being careful not to touch one of those risks that are in their lives. If they touch one, they have to do 5 push-ups, because that's the consequence of getting into trouble with one of those risks. And then the whole group will do 5 push-ups, because it's a community problem and everybody's problem.
A boy is the first to hit a cone. The girls cheer and the boys all curse in a mixture of Spanish and Haitian Creole as they drop and do 5 push-ups. Of course, push-ups and HIV education aren't the primary reason these kids showed up on a hot Sunday afternoon. Osiris is a 20-year-old student from a neighboring Bate.
I'm here today because I have some friend. He invited me here. I'm come here for play.
Much to Osiris' delight, the lessons eventually end, and the games begin. A goat runs across the playing field, and Kirk Friedrich, Grassroots Soccer co-founder and sometime referee, chases it away, and play resumes. As it does in all the countries it operates in, Grassroots Soccer has routinely shared its curriculum with local organizations here to make sure its HIV prevention message doesn't end with the weekend tournament. For the World Vision Report, I'm Michael Cavanaugh in the Dominican Republic.
There's some controversy about whether it's better to breastfeed or bottle feed babies born to HIV-positive mothers in the developing world. But one thing is clear, orphans who don't have access to breast milk are almost certain to suffer as a result. Studies show that infants who don't get breast milk are 6 times more likely to die than those who do. That's because breast milk gives babies immunity from disease. Formula is the alternative. But if there's no clean water, then formula gets mixed with dirty water, and babies may die of diseases like diarrhea and dysentery. So untainted breast milk is in high demand. Jill Yaus didn't know these facts and figures when she had her first child. What she did know was that she had way too much milk for one baby.
Literally, when I'd open my freezer, bags of milk would come tumbling onto the floor, and my husband said, okay, we got to get rid of this. So I started thinking, what am I going to do with all this extra milk? I knew that my daughter wasn't going to be able to drink it all, so I just did a Google search, and I found out about this incredible milk bank in South Africa. So I contacted them about donating milk, and I assumed that there had been many other women out there who'd probably donated to this bank before. And when they responded back, they said, you do realize we're in South Africa. And I said, well, yeah. And so she said, well, we've never had international donations before. And she emailed all of her contacts around the world to see if anybody had ever tried to donate milk internationally. And sure enough, it hadn't been done before.
Who's been giving them the milk up until now?
It's wealthy women in Johannesburg that are donating their milk to these orphans. In Africa, clearly there's a shortage of healthy moms with, I think it's about 40% of moms have HIV, are HIV positive. So all the parents are dying and we're left with all these orphans and no breast milk.
Did you know much about AIDS orphans in Africa? Was this a particular interest of yours already?
To be honest, it wasn't something that I knew a whole lot about. And that's part of the issue, too, is we feel so far away from Africa. And a lot of times I think we just feel, well, what are we supposed to do about it? We're here in Columbia, Missouri, or Rochester, Minnesota, or wherever we might be sheltered and comfortable. And a lot of times I think we just don't know what we can do to make a difference. And this was one small way that I thought I could do a little something.
So how did you get it to South Africa without it being spoiled?
That's a good question, and that was one of my first challenges, and that was the question that I got back from the milk bank originally in Africa was, you know, we would do anything for this milk. We're dying for this milk. We could really use it, but we don't know how to make this happen. And I said, well, I'm on maternity leave. Let me research this for you. You take care of those babies. And so I started calling shipping companies and researching, and my original plan was just to fly the milk there myself because I found out that it would cost more to ship than it would to fly it over there myself. And when I get an idea in my head, man, I am hell-bent on getting it done. So I was going to get my milk to Africa one way or another. And I had figured that there were moms all over that may be interested in getting their milk to Africa, too. So I just started a website. Apparently, it kind of caught on and word of mouth spread. But to answer your question, the first shipment was an exchange with my milk and a representative from South Africa at the Chicago airport. This wonderful businessman, he basically checked it with his luggage. And here's this, you know, older businessman carrying around this huge box of milk that says breast milk and dry ice.
And did it get there safely?
Perfectly frozen.
I'm interested in actually this website you say you designed, and you also, along with it, started this organization called the International Breast Milk Project. What kind of response have you gotten?
I have been so floored by the response that I've gotten from American moms and Canadian moms, too. And even moms from faraway places like Ghana and Norway, and just moms all over the world, in fact, have been emailing saying, I want to donate my milk. How can I be a part of this?
How many moms are donating milk today?
Well, we've grown from one donor myself to over 1,000 applicants today. And so from January through May, we collected about 55,000 ounces. And so all of that is being shipped to South Africa. So we actually had to get a cold storage facility to store the milk. It's going to be about 10 pallets full. Quick International, a shipping company that specializes in specialty shipping, has donated the shipping of this milk, which is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. And you were someone who didn't even think you were going to breastfeed at all. Now you're breastfeeding orphans in Africa.
Yeah, I used to joke that I could feed a whole continent with all that milk. So even if it was just feeding one or two babies, it was so worth every drop, every effort, every late night, every early morning pumping. It's just so cool to see that connection because, you know, I could send $50, I could send $100, but it's just not the same feeling as seeing them with your milk.
And Jill, I understand you're expecting your second child now.
I am. I'm sitting here almost 7 months pregnant.
Are you going to keep donating milk?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm going to break some records this time.
All right. Jill Yaus, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Jill Yaus is now the mother of two healthy children. She's the founder of the International Breast Milk Project. You can find out more about Jill's work at our website, worldvisionreport.org. Evans Ondiambo is an AIDS orphan. He's one of thousands in the East African country of Kenya. He lives in the fishing village of Osenge on the shores of Lake Victoria. This is his story in his own words.
My name is Evans Ondiambo. My old is 17 years old.
I'm 17 years old. My father died in March 2003. They say he died of HIV. And my mother died this year, in April 2006. Even my mother died of HIV.
It's pek maneno eni kaka andal kani dala kucha.
At home, people deserted us, so we don't have anyone to lean on. The whole responsibility is on me, and it's hard. That's why I've come here to find something we can live on. I won't say it's bad, but at least I can work. The little I get, I can sit down and say, this one I take for my brother, maybe for his education. This one I keep for myself, and this one I can use for other things, maybe clothes. But it's not enough. Whatever I do, it's not enough. But we get by. I don't feel good with my parents. They never took responsibility and kept themselves safe against AIDS. If they had taken their lives seriously, maybe we wouldn't be facing these problems. So I'm not happy about it, about them, because now we are suffering for no good reason. If they were responsible, they would still be here to take good care of us. I want to take care of myself, of my good life, so I don't succumb to that calamity, AIDS.
Evan's story was brought to us by reporter Richard Locke in Kenya. Some mental health workers have expressed concern about the psychological fallout from this epidemic. As you just heard, Evans is very angry with his parents for contracting HIV. We wanted to know if anything is being done to help kids cope with their parents' diagnosis. So we sent Richard Locke to South Africa, the epicenter of the AIDS epidemic, where more than 1 million children have been orphaned by the disease. In KwaZulu-Natal, he found some social workers and families facing the problem head-on. Here's his report.
39-year-old Marco Susanna Matembu lies under a blanket as she looks through faded family photos with her 15-year-old daughter. Every movement she makes is an effort. She pauses on a photo of herself in a yellow swimsuit, relaxing in the warm waters of the Indian Ocean.
2001.
It's me. It's your mom. I was at Durban Beach in 2001. My health was good at that time. Those were happy days.
Today, Marco Susanna is HIV positive. She feels continually weak. But her immune system is still too strong for her to be put on antiretroviral drugs. Once she is on medication, it's possible she might live for many years to come. It's now 5 years since she discovered she was infected.
The day I received my results that I'm HIV positive, I felt shocked and didn't believe. And I thought I was going to die soon and leave my children. But now, I have accepted it, although it's painful.
Marco Susanna is a single mother of two. She and her daughters live in a one-room house in the impoverished township of Edendale. The family pictures Marco Susanna shows her daughter Felicia are among the sentimental items she's put away in a so-called memory box. It's a simple container, the size of a shoebox, painted in bright colours by her youngest daughter.
In this memory box, she has put all the most important things so that when she dies, the children will remember her.
One of the purposes of the memory box is to help the children recall the good times spent with their parents.
These are cards. We used to make cards and send it to one of us. This one is from me. I'm sending it to my daughter, youngest daughter, telling her to have a nice day.
Eventually, the photos, letters, and pieces of jewelry will provide the kids with a legacy of their parents' life and love. Memory boxes are usually made with the help of a social worker, and the process encourages families to talk about HIV. Marco Susana says she was typical of those who struggled to overcome the taboo surrounding the virus.
Through memory work, I felt strong enough to disclose my status in the presence of my children, and my eldest daughter cried a lot.
Temba Baloy is a social worker who works with HIV parents and their families.
We ask family members to include the children in the process so that they can listen to their stories and also given that opportunity to express their concerns or feelings.
Not all children have the chance to do these activities with their ailing parents. In the neighbouring township of Snouting, 14-year-old Fikile helps her grandmother with washing the dishes. Fikile's mother died of HIV in 2004, but her grandmother Paulina always told her that her mother died of a chest infection. Then a local organisation that works with AIDS orphans began to counsel Fikile. Part of that work involved making a memory box. Afterwards, her grandmother felt Fikile was strong enough to deal with the truth.
Now we feel free to talk to Fikile about HIV/AIDS. If she asks any question, then we can give her the answer.
This is my exercise. Fikile's pain is clearly raw as she rummages through her memory box, a simple wooden container that holds a handful of photos, a cassette, and her mother's identity card. She fights to hold her tears back as she runs a hand over a picture of her and her mother.
When she had money, she would take us to town and buy us beautiful things. I remember a pink dress. She was a mom who loved her children, and she always wanted to help those who needed help.
But her grandmother believes there's another reason why Fikile needs to express her feelings about her mother's life and death. Fikile also suffers from frequent chest infections and weight loss. Her grandmother fears the teenager might be HIV positive and knows she must be tested soon. For the World Vision Report, I'm Richard Locke in KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa.
There are pictures of memory boxes at our website, worldvisionreport.org. And coming up, Indian truck drivers take home more than just their paychecks. We hear about a program to stop truckers from spreading HIV. Stay with us. Welcome back to the World Vision Report, AIDS Up Close. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Prevention is better than cure. It's an old cliche, but one that's become a mantra in the fight against HIV. In India, government officials say their efforts to slow the march of HIV are working. But some healthcare workers fear that AIDS could explode there in the next few years, the way it did in Africa. HIV is concentrated mostly among India's 3 million prostitutes and 6 million long-distance truckers. But it doesn't stop there. Truckers who visit prostitutes then go home to their wives, and they take the virus with them. A program funded by the Gates Foundation is trying to stop the problem at its source. Miranda Kennedy reports from New Delhi.
Take your average truck driver in India. He spends 15 or 20 days of a month on the road. He's pretty likely to visit inexpensive commercial sex workers at highway truck stops, like this one outside New Delhi, during the long stretches away from his family. These truck stops offer chai, cheap food, spare parts, and sex. If the trucker catches HIV here, he'll take it back to his wife in his village. Trucker Gulmir Singh has seen it firsthand. Recently, he lost a friend to AIDS.
He always had a fever. He was weak and emaciated. And even though he took medicine, he never got better. Most of the day, he couldn't move from his bed. And then, after 3 years, he died. We're all afraid of this dangerous disease. And we have talked amongst ourselves about how to be careful not to get it.
Gulmir admits his friend's death hasn't stopped him from cheating on his wife with prostitutes. Gulmir, like many truck drivers in India, believes that if he doesn't have sex for a long time, it will result in death or blindness. So they're unfaithful when they're on the road. What has changed is that Gulmir now uses a condom. He learned that condoms help protect against HIV from a peer education project promoted by the Gates Foundation. The project trains truckers to tell other truckers about AIDS, how it's spread, and how to reduce the risk of getting it through condom use. Akash, a truck mechanic, is coded in Greece, and he talks in the dialect used by many truckers in these parts. He explains how condoms protect against AIDS and is quick to put to rest the common trucker myths about needing to have sex when they're away from home. The Gates Foundation refuses to take a moral stand on the issue of men being unfaithful to their wives and paying for prostitutes. So to keep the AIDS epidemic from skyrocketing across the country, the Gates Foundation's goal is simply to promote condom use. Cedric Finch is Regional Health Program Director for the humanitarian aid group CARE in India. He says that when CARE talks to truck drivers, they emphasize abstinence and faithfulness first, before talking about condoms.
Abstinence, definitely we suggest to them because we feel that that's the best way. They need to be faithful to their spouses.
They sometimes even help truckers decide not to visit commercial sex workers.
If I'm able to just talk to him during that period about himself, about his kids, about his family, just remind him of them. Just trying to take him away from thinking about going to a commercial sex worker.
Asha Rao is project director of the AIDS Prevention Program at India's largest trucking company, the Transport Corporation of India.
It's not that they're not concerned about the family at home. It's not that they don't save money for their children. But the lifestyle is so different. So it's like in a total switch from one lifestyle to another when they are at home, which is also for a very short duration. So when you go home, you buy this gift, you buy that gift, you're with your wife for a short while, and then again you're back on the roads.
Rao says it wasn't hard for the Gates Foundation to convince the trucking company to work with them to help cut down AIDS infections among truckers. Some estimates have found that 10% of India's trucker population is already HIV positive. That figure is high enough to make any trucking executive care about what his workers do at night. For the World Vision Report, I'm Miranda Kennedy in New Delhi.
Something similar is happening a little closer to home. Mexican migrant workers come to the United States hoping to build a better life for themselves and their families. Many have dreams of returning to Mexico, taking hard-earned dollars back with them. But like the Indian truckers, some Mexican migrants are taking the HIV virus home. Kurt Organista, a social scientist at the University of California at Berkeley, has talked with a number of migrant workers.
People talk about missing their families. They talk about how they feel depressed or lonely. And so what happens there is they become frustrated, you know, with the lack of human warmth and contacts with people.
Some of them turn to prostitutes. Organista says migrants are also vulnerable to men cruising the internet for sex.
There are websites now where people will tell you, you know, how to pick up day laborers, that they're desperate for money, that you can offer them work, and then when they're at your home, you can offer them a $50 bill for a sexual favor.
It's difficult to know just how many migrant workers from Mexico are infected with HIV. Whatever the count, this is one import Mexico could do without. Thailand once led the way in HIV prevention. The government's program to stop the spread of HIV was a model for many other countries. But things are changing in Thailand. Funding for AIDS programs has dropped, and the number of people infected with the virus is rising. The World Vision Report's Cynthia Graber has this story about some monks who haven't wavered in their commitment to fighting AIDS.
Hundreds of monks sit cross-legged on the floor in Wat Prasing, a temple in the northern city of Chiang Mai. The deep red carpet provides a vibrant backdrop for the monks' orange and yellow robes. More than 90% of people in Thailand are Buddhist. Go to even the smallest town, and there's usually at least one temple. And the monks are at the center of these temples. So it was natural that people who were first infected with HIV/AIDS more than 20 years ago first turned to those monks for help. The result was a project called Sangha Metta, a name that references the Buddhist virtue of compassion. Pramaha Bunchwai heads up the effort. He says in the 1980s and 90s, AIDS patients were ostracized from their communities. So they moved into the local temples to find care.
At the beginning, it is really very necessary to have those people living with HIV to live in the monastery because of the stigma and discrimination from the society.
But then the monks realized they were called to play a larger role. They basically became community organizers. Pramaha Bunchwai says this work is based on a basic precept in Buddhism. It's called metta, or loving kindness.
Because when you see people in suffering, when you have metta, when you have loving kindness or compassion in you, then definitely you would do something in order to solve the problem.
That loving kindness is very much on display here in a small temple about an hour outside of Chiang Mai. Two monks and a half dozen community members are putting together bags of food, milk, and seeds for families in the area affected by AIDS. The group drives about a mile away over dirt-packed roads and gets out at the first house on today's list. The family pig rolls around in an enclosure in the backyard. The house is a small building made of what look like cement blocks with a metal roof. Everyone sits cross-legged on mats on the floor. It's obvious who's sick here. The young man, Sangha Sutikep, is 29, a former furniture maker. His parents sit with him to accept visitors. He's gaunt, shaky, with mottled skin. His gaze is unfocused, and he's already lost sight in one of his eyes. The monks begin taking provisions out of the bags and ask what bean seeds he'd like. Sutikep is weak, but not yet completely disabled, so growing food in the garden is one way he can help his family. He says he'd prefer long beans, and the monks say they'll buy the beans back from him after he grows them. The abbot, or head monk of the temple, Pramaha Prakutanawat, sits next to him. Throughout the visit, Pramaha Tanawat holds the young man's hand, strokes his arm, rubs his head, touches his leg. Sutikep says these visits have meant the world to him.
I feel good. I'm happy that people are concerned for me and aren't neglecting me.
Before he leaves, the abbot says he'll arrange for a hospital visit to see if anything can be done about Sutikep's vision. Before the day is over, the group visits six families in the small town. That's a high concentration of AIDS victims in such a tiny area. Pramaha Tanawat explains that many of the men used to visit local prostitutes, and they never used condoms. This brings up another role the monks fill. These ascetic, celibate men find themselves in the unlikely role of sex educators. In keeping with their faith, the monks teach villagers to be faithful in marriage. But because they know not everyone will heed their advice, the monks also partner with local healthcare workers who educate about condom use. Pramaha Insorn, another abbot involved in the project, says the community first balked at the idea of monks talking to them about sexual practice.
In the beginning, people didn't buy into it. They were uncomfortable talking to monks about sex, but then they came to accept it.
The monks also teach meditation techniques to AIDS patients. Again, Pramaha Insorn.
Meditation can make people feel more relaxed. They're no longer hopeless. They learn to see themselves as more valuable, and they can give more to people around them.
The monks in Thailand are now working with monks in other predominantly Buddhist countries, sharing information about how to best help victims of HIV/AIDS. Pramaha Bunchwai is in charge of that effort. He says this work fulfills the deepest mandates of his religion, stretching back to the time of the Buddha.
Buddha himself, when he first sent the group of the monks to teach, what he says that, go, monk, my monk, for the benefit of the people, for the happiness of the many.
For the happiness of the many, Buddha said, and for the welfare of the world. For the World Vision Report, I'm Cynthia Graber in Chiang Mai, Thailand.
Sunshine, that's my shoe, whatever.
And now a tribute. Cynthia Lashomo was a beauty queen from Botswana in southern Africa. But hers was no ordinary title. She was named Miss HIV Stigma Free. Cynthia was crowned in 2005 and became a crusader, speaking out against the discrimination faced by people with HIV. Cynthia touched many, many lives before she lost hers to AIDS. This report, produced by Sonia Varma, first aired in February of 2006, just 10 months before Cynthia died. We're airing it here again, in honor of Cynthia's courage and determination in her fight against HIV/AIDS.
I may be HIV positive, but I'm not a victim.
Cynthia Lashomo tells this crowd of 100 what most in Botswana wouldn't dare, her HIV status.
When the results came out positive, I could not believe my ears. Why me? Young and beautiful as I was. I'm so beautiful. What was more, I was not of the class to be infected.
The crowd nods in agreement. Lashomo dispels the myth that the HIV virus infects only the poor and ugly. She tells them we're all at risk. It's words like this that won Lashomo the title of Miss HIV Stigma Free. The 32-year-old travels around Botswana with her message. Today, she's talking to employees of the Federal Agriculture Department. Lashomo may be an HIV beauty queen, but she's not the image of a bone-thin sufferer. She's got curves and energy. That's because Lashomo takes a cocktail of antiretroviral drugs.
I'm very proud of being crowned Miss HIV Stigma Free because I'm saving the nation. I'm living positively with HIV. I play the safer way.
Lashomo admits she didn't always play it safe. She had unprotected premarital sex. She was also assaulted by two men.
I've been raped.
It's not easy to be so candid, but Botswanans can't afford to shy away from the facts, not when their country has an infection rate of nearly 40%. So Lashomo drills home this message.
Those who don't know their status, they should go for HIV testing.
Be safe, she says, be faithful, and also be accepting of those infected with HIV.
I'm not sick. I'm just living with this virus. We are just like anyone else. We are normal.
Some are clearly convinced.
I shed a tear the moment she started speaking. And I think from here, I'm the first person to go to the testing center just to get to know my status.
I appreciate that this lady is telling the truth about HIV/AIDS. I will go and test myself.
Botswana's AIDS program is the most comprehensive on the continent, and it has some big-name supporters like Bill Gates. His foundation has donated $50 million. That's being used on prevention campaigns and to distribute the drugs. Merck Pharmaceutical has matched the funds and thrown in free HIV meds. Still, there's not much point to free medicine if people are afraid to get tested. Brad Ryder says that's where the Miss HIV pageant helps. He works at the Botswanan government's main HIV/AIDS program.
It's really to show another face of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. For years, the world has been bombarded, and it's no different in Botswana, with media images of the sick and the dying related to HIV/AIDS. So people like Cynthia really are providing hope for others that there is life after an HIV/AIDS test, that you can live a healthy, productive life, provided that you receive ARV treatment. And one offshoot of that would hopefully be that more people will come forward and get themselves tested for HIV.
Message you would think. Of our ignorance.
Lashomo keeps up a rigorous schedule of 2, sometimes 3 speaking engagements a week, advising young and old to play it safe. As for her, she's doing all the right things.
I'm taking my medication. I don't sleep around. I'm in control of my virus.
Lashomo knows, like everyone, she'll die one day, but she vows it'll be old age, not AIDS, that takes her. For the World Vision Report, I'm Sonia Varma in Gaborone, Botswana.
Sadly, Cynthia didn't live to old age, but her legacy lives on. Her dream was to build an orphanage for children whose parents have died from AIDS. Now her parents are working hard to make sure that their daughter's dream is realized.
We are together.
leave you today with music from the Soweto AIDS Choir. The chorus is made up of volunteers. They spend their time taking care of people with HIV/AIDS in the South African township of Soweto. They get together every week to sing. Chorus members say this keeps their spirits up in the face of this devastating disease. And that brings us to the end of today's show. You can find out more about the program and where to find us at our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can listen to the show there, or you can podcast it if you want to take us with you. Our radio team includes Beverly Abel, Doug Boyles, Chris Baldiga, Mark Bandy, Chris Darden, Cynthia Graber, Lita Hartman, Diane Toomey, and I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.